It is a great pleasure to welcome David McCullough to the program. If the old cliche that he needs no introduction is relevant, it is surely relevant or appropriate tonight all the same. And a quick introduction, David McCullough won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Truman, of President Truman, titled simply Truman. He earlier did very interesting historical narratives on the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, on Theodore Roosevelt, and many other such topics. And, of course, he was for many years the host of the PBS series The American Experience. And now there has just appeared, after I wonder how many years of work, I'll ask that almost instantly, his biography of John Adams, the second president of the United States, titled directly, simply, John Adams. I guess the first question is, why didn't you follow the style set with the biography of Truman? Why didn't you title this one simply Adams?
Well, because, among other things, there would be some confusion. Was it Sam Adams or John Adams?
Yeah.
And
or John Quincy Adams.
Or John Quincy Adams. And John Adams, well, a little like Harry Potter, you know, that's his name, John Adams. And there's something I felt very characteristic about the name, very straightforward and nothing ambiguous about it. Two good names, John and Adams.
Seems to me you sort of fell in love with this guy. You started, I know, with the idea of doing a book on the relationship between Adams and Jefferson. But after a while, you abandoned Jefferson.
Well, somebody said it's almost impossible not to love Adams. They said it in his own day. Jefferson mm-hmm. said it. In a letter to Madison. Madison hadn't met Adams yet. He'd only read about him because Adams had been in Europe for a great many years. And after spending several weeks with Adams in England, Jefferson, when he got back to Paris, Jefferson then being our ambassador or minister to France, while Adams was our minister to London, wrote a letter to Madison, and he said, you know, if you knew this man, you would love him, as I do. He was not an easy person to be with all the time. He was abrasive. He could be abrasive. He was often vain, often stubborn, fiercely independent, a man of definite opinions, sometimes candid to the point of being tactless. And those qualities have been repeated again and again by historians. You know, they say that history doesn't repeat itself, but historians do. And I must say that I had pretty much that impression of him when I first thought about doing this book. Actually, I was going to do a book about Jefferson and Adams and their intertwining lives. But once I got into it, once I began to read about him and read what he himself said in his diaries and his letters, and particularly what he wrote to his wife, I realized that there was far more to him than sort of the stereotypical little plump John Adams standing between the two tall, glamorous Virginians. That, in fact, he was passionate, affectionate, loyal to his friends, loyal to his family, a devoted father, devoted son, devoted husband. And his devotion to the cause of America was really without equal. He was never a sunshine soldier. This was a fellow who was there when you needed him.
One sense that one gets from the way you treat not merely Adams, but all the men around him, and that time, that is the time of the Revolution, and even the years before leading up to that crucial day of July 4th, 1776, a sense that one gets is that they were engaged in a very perilous enterprise. That in fact, Franklin was right when he said to the Continental Congress, we must hang together, or most assuredly we will all hang separately, because they were making a revolution when the larger portion of the colonial population wasn't really in favor of it.
No, if they had taken a poll in the colonies in 1776, they would have called the whole thing off. They would have scrapped it, because only about a third of the population was for it. Certainly an equal third were adamantly against it.
Tories.
They were Tories and loyal to the king, loyal to the crown. They were English subjects, and they wished to remain so. And the other third, in the old human tradition, were sort of waiting to see which side won. Mm-hmm. And Adams, who had a remarkable gift for foresight, he loved the fables of La Fontaine and arguing cases before the bar as a young lawyer. He would again and again quote lines from his favorite La Fontaine. And one of them was that in everything one must consider the end. Whenever you start, think about what the end is going to be. And one of the most far-seeing judgments that Adams exercised was he said that this is not going to be a quick, easy war. Everybody else was saying it's going to be over very quickly. Thomas Paine was saying, oh, we have all these natural resources, a great Atlantic Ocean separates us from the powers of Europe, so forth and so on. Adams said, not at all. It's going to be a very long war. It's going to be very costly. It's going to be very bloody. He said it was going to last 10 years. He was off, but not far. It would last 8 years.
I was struck by the point you make, a quantitative comparison, that those guys are all down there in Philadelphia working towards the final declaration and then trying to staff and manage the war. And the city of Philadelphia, which is the functioning capital of the newly declared independent Confederation of States, has a total population of some 32,000, as I remember it. At around that time, the British land on Staten Island with 36,000 soldiers.
That's right. More troops than the entire population of the largest city in the colonies. Now imagine if an enemy, a foe, landed an army that was bigger than the population of our largest city.
Exactly.
And you have nothing to stop them. And they're only about a day and a half's march from where you are. And they are not just numerous, they're the best troops in the world. They're tough, they're well-disciplined, they're well-equipped, and they've come to do business of crushing these rebels.
You know, I saw that film, The Patriot, which appeared perhaps about a year ago, made the Brits rather angry, apparently. And watching it, I thought, boy, this really represents it all in a very bloody way. I saw that a few months ago before reading your book, and reading your book, it seemed to me that the two coincided. It was a far bloodier war, far more was at risk than we think from the far distance as we look back to the myth of the Revolution.
I that's absolutely right. It was bloody. It was what happens when in a civil war where you had Americans killing Americans, you had American troops fighting on the British side.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a war in which our side was under enormous handicaps. At the start of the war, George Washington never commanded an army in a battle. You had troops from every part of America, all the different colonies, who had no great love necessarily for some of those from the other colonies. You had a whole mix of armament. There was no money to finance the war. There was no discipline. Soldiers signed up for a few months at a time, and when their enlistment was over, they'd walk away.
Turns out, I learned from you, because I really didn't know this either, that the selection of Washington to be the commanding general was essentially an initiative
of John Adams.
Of John Adams.
He put Washington's name in nomination, which was not only an astute move in picking a great leader, but it was also a very sound political move, because he was being sent, as you remember, to take command of the troops at Boston, where they had the British under siege in the city of Boston. But those troops were all New Englanders.
Mm-hmm.
So to make it truly an American effort to have the commanding officer... Bring the patrician from Virginia.
Yeah.
Adams also was the one who said that it ought to be Thomas Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. And later on, when he was president, he's the one who put John Marshall on the Supreme Court, maybe the greatest Chief Justice we ever had. So as a casting director, if nothing else, he was quite able.
I find this fascinating sentence someplace in your book. We pause in a moment for some commercials, but I want to read this and then pursue it shortly. You say, the hardest thing to convey in writing history is that nothing had to turn out the way it did, which leads me to the sort of thing that I so much enjoy when one examines history, whether ancient, revolutionary, or modern, that is the counterfactual. What if, I pose the question, John Adams had succumbed to those dreadful winters in Braintree, Massachusetts, and had died of the influenza or of pneumonia at the ripe age of 32, when he was a very active lawyer in and around Boston. What if there had not been a John Adams in Philadelphia? Might things have turned out differently? We return directly to David McCullough, drawing from his wonderful new narrative biography of the second president, John Adams. First, we pause for these words. Our guest tonight, and it's a great pleasure to have him here, of course, is David McCullough, an old friend of this program, and the author now of, I said as I was doing the pre-introduction, that it's a cliche adjective, but one uses it occasionally, even though one has to risk the cliche. But this is a magisterial biography.
Thank you,
sir.
It's
a great volume, a biography of John Adams. And that is published by Simon & Schuster. It will be on the New York Times bestseller list in the position of number one, I am informed, this coming Sunday. I'm sure that will be true on the Chicago Tribune list as well. If not this week, then by next week. And we are, it's, I just want to say this once. I really don't need, you don't need a testimonial from me, but this is utterly compelling reading, and you've got this great gift to convey in narrative form the texture of a life and the human quality of a life, as well as the larger issues into which that life was involved and to which that life contributed. And thus, it's truly a wonderful read. And one learns a great deal about the making of America, which doesn't come through in some of the drier tomes that one has encountered reading about the founders and the time of the Revolution and the early years of the Republic. All of that brings me back to the question of the nature of history and the importance of the hero in history, to put it in Thomas Carlyle's phrase. I quote again this comment from your book: the hardest thing to convey in writing history is that nothing had to turn out the way it did. If there had not been a John Adams, if he'd been cut down by disease or whatever, as so many were in those days, would American history have been significantly different?
Yes, I think it would have. I think it would have been significantly different in several ways. First of all, it is very unlikely that the Declaration of Independence would have been passed when it was. And had it not been passed in early July, it might never have been voted through. Because of the presence, just as you were saying earlier, of that enormous British army that was suddenly so close. There was strong opposition to the passage of the Declaration of Independence in the Congress itself, led by a formidable and very deeply patriotic American, John Dickinson, who said he didn't think that we ought to launch such an effort on a skiff of paper. He thought that the timing was wrong. He thought a reconciliation could be worked out with Great Britain. And Adams, who had seen what the British had done in New England after they after Lexington Concord, knew that he was being naive, that Dickinson was being naive. And with great force of his own presence, his own ability to make a case, I won't call it eloquence, because I don't think it was eloquent in the sense that we usually understand that word. It was more the force of argument. He drove the Declaration through the Congress. Jefferson said he moved us from our seats. He called him the Colossus of Independence. Others, Benjamin Rush, said he was absolutely the first man in the House. He got them to vote for it, and he gave a speech that lasted 2 hours. It was the greatest speech of his life, and one of the greatest speeches in American history. It turned history. And we don't know what he said, because it was all conducted behind closed doors. No records were kept in order to enforce secrecy. We have a good idea what he said, and we know that he had great powers of persuasion. If he were to go on with his career, and what did it matter? Would things have been different? He wrote the oldest written constitution still in use in the world today, the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Some 10 years before the writing of
That's
the
right.
Constitution of the United States.
And a very great influence on the Constitution of the United States. It had a Bill of Rights, which our Constitution didn't, as you know, have at the start. It provided virtually everything that our Constitution, our national Constitution, provides, with the exception of freedom of religion, which he knew to be a failing. And later on, when he was in his 80s, he went to a constitutional convention in Boston to argue for an amendment providing religious freedom. Mm-hmm. And his amendment failed. And he wrote a touching letter to Jefferson saying, I think I've lost my powers, you know.
Yeah.
If this had been me in my youth, I could have put it across.
You say when he was in his 80s. In fact, it's worth noting just in passing that he was the most long-lived of all presidents so far. I think he was 91
That's
at his
right,
death.
Almost 91.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he has many firsts. He was the first president to occupy the White House. He was the first and only president who had the daunting task of succeeding George Washington. He was the first president to run against his own vice president,
Thomas Jefferson. He was also the first president to have a son who became president until
That's
rather
right.
recently.
That's right. He was first president from New England, first president who was a Harvard graduate, first president to be a graduate of any college. First president to have been a school teacher, first president to be a to have been a published author. He's the only founding father, the only one, who never owned a slave as a matter of principle. And I think that's extremely important.
The only one?
The only one.
Did Benjamin Franklin
yes,
own slaves?
He did.
Really? I didn't know.
So did John Hancock. So did Benjamin.
Now, Hancock was up there in Boston.
Yes. Sam Adams owned a slave at one point. He freed her very soon after she was given to him. Adams never owned a slave, but I think what's important is he did. It was a matter of principle.
Sure,
it wasn't any circumstances prevented. And his wife, of course, has to be taken into consideration in the evaluation.
You estimate her at the highest level.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you can't understand him without understanding her. He very very rightly said before he married her that. He said, what I need is ballast. And she was that. And she was his best friend. She was his most trusted advisor. She was had a keen political sense. She loved politics. She loved being at the center of things. But she was also the one that managed the farm, managed the family finances, educated the children, ran things, kept them in the black, which was never easy. In all those years, during all those years, when he was either off off in Philadelphia, or over in Europe serving the country as a diplomat.
That phase of his career is not as well known, I think, to those who have some portion of the history of the early United States in mind. They do the Declaration of Independence. He's a crucial figure in the Continental Congress. But by 1970, there, my mistake, you said Florida, I've said 19. By 1777, or is it 78, he's off to Europe to represent us first to the court of Louis the 16th. It's in France before the French Revolution. He also, later on in the Netherlands, seems to have a major success in getting them to really help to fund the American Revolution.
Bankroll the Revolution.
Well, he gets the sense that maybe without his ministries in Europe, the Revolution might have failed.
I don't think there's any question about that. And I think that we wound up with one of the best treaties this nation ever signed at the end of the Revolution, in good part because of his persistence and determination, the Treaty of Paris, which signed in 1783, ended the revolution, but also established that we were an independent nation and the boundaries of the nation, all the way to the Mississippi.
He's one of the people
double the size of
the
country.
One of the people negotiating the treaty.
Yes, indeed, with Franklin and John Jay.
Yeah.
He then is our first ambassador to the court of St. James.
Imagine that, being the American ambassador to England just after we have
yes,
defeated England in a revolutionary war.
Yeah, and only a matter of years before, if they'd caught him, he would have been hanged. He was a traitor. And there he stands, this farmer's son from Quincy, Massachusetts, in front of George III, representing the new United States of America. It was a very memorable moving scene.
How did George
III? And in fact, both the two men were so moved by it, yes, they had trouble speaking.
Really? George III didn't just view him with disdain, then.
No, he didn't. In some ways, they were quite alike. They both loved farming. They both loved books. Mm-hmm. They both loved their families. George III had 15 children. Did you know that, Milt?
I knew he had quite a few.
And they were both quite devout. They both were early risers. And I think you could fairly say that they were both devout, profound patriots.
By this time, George was beyond the madness of King George.
No, it was before.
Was it before?
Before.
The porphyria that later
affected
him? Yes,
that's right. It's before. But there was vast difference between them, which is far more important than the similarities. One was the King of England, and the other was a mere farmer's son from Braintree or Quincy, Massachusetts. His 3 years in England as our minister to the court of St. James's was in many ways a very frustrating time in his life, because the British were in no hurry to see us succeed. They were in no hurry to carry out the what they'd agreed to at the Treaty of Paris.
They were still smoldering, and many of them were still thinking we can reverse this thing.
They didn't like us. They didn't like him. They tolerated his presence. They were sort of icy cold, properly respectful, but he had an interesting time nonetheless. That wonderful episode where Jefferson comes over and they're trying to make some contact and make some progress with negotiations on treaties with Lord Carmarthen, who was the foreign secretary, and getting nowhere whatsoever. So they said, the heck with it, let's go off and take a tour of the English gardens.
There you go, do that botanical tour. And I understand that you and your wife duplicated that
tour. Yes, we did. We followed the same route, the same time of year, day by day.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see what it looked like, wanted to see what was in bloom and what the how far the trees were out and what the look along the Thames was. And many of those places are still very much as they were, and many of the towns are exactly as they were. There are inns and buildings of some consequence that were there when they went through.
We want to bring him forward to the vice presidency under George Washington shortly, but for a moment, darting back in time to the days when revolutionary ferment was growing, and to one of the first bloodlettings, namely the so-called Boston Massacre, which had been fomented by his second cousin, Samuel Adams, and the British did shoot and kill some six or seven people who were, British troops did, kill some six or seven who were sort of taunting them and maybe threatening them. And what I frankly never knew, though it must be commonplace in American history, is that those British soldiers were defended by none other than John Adams.
John Adams. Nobody else would defend them. They came and asked him, would he do it? He said, I will. It was a very courageous act.
Very.
And furthermore, he got them off. And here he was, one of the patriots, one of the people who were as outraged by the British and their presence and their troops as anyone, but felt that this, if we were going to show that we were respected the government of laws and not of men, then we'd have to give them a fair trial.
We are due for some commercials once again. Then we get Adams back over the seas this is after they put together the new Constitution, get beyond the Articles of Confederation, and we've got a president. And, of course, the president is George Washington, and the vice president
is
John Adams. We need to talk about his relationship with Washington in those years and his role as vice president and ultimately on to his term, his single term as president. Some crucial issues arose. He handled himself in many ways with tremendous calm and with a calculating sense of what the nation needed to be secured and to be established and to go on functioning beyond the age of the charismatic central figure, George Washington. Because whatever else Adams was, he wasn't quite charismatic, was he?
No, never. Nor could anybody even begin to fill George Washington's shoes.
We return directly to David McCullough, continuing to draw from this superb new biography, John Adams, that's published by Simon & Schuster, right after we pause for these words. I announce, as I sometimes do, but tonight it's more than profoundly true. You just can't do justice to a book like John Adams by David McCullough in a two-hour program punctuated by six commercial breaks. There's too much in this book. And we need to talk about the making of this book itself, which we will do shortly. But let's get him back to the United States. Of course, the system was different then with regard to presidential elections, wasn't it?
Yes, the winner became the president, and the runner-up became the vice president. And in that first election, there were no political parties, and Washington was certain to be elected, and he was unanimously in the electoral vote. And it was pretty clear that Adams would be elected vice president, in part because he was a Northerner, a New Englander, but also because people felt that of all those who had contributed to their country, who'd been in service and distinguished themselves by both the courage and the idealism of the time, that Adams merited that place. So he was elected and served as vice president, a role he hated, and for which he was very ill-suited.
There's that famous quotation of his about this.
Yes, he said the American people, in their wisdom, had devised the most insignificant office ever imagined or imposed upon any one individual. However,
he served
loyally and diligently in that job. He scarcely ever missed a day in the Senate.
And as presiding officer of the Senate, he had many tie votes, and he was the crucial guy in some 30 or 35 of those votes, wasn't he?
That's right. He broke more ties than any vice president in our history. Mm-hmm. And he was always there to support administration policy, administration proposals. His problem at first was he couldn't stay out of debate, and he got off to a very bad start, on a very wrong foot, in proposing fancy titles for people. You know, that the president should be referred to as His Excellency. And it was against the grain of the American spirit at the moment. Maybe he'd been too long in Europe, too long away from the country. But he was not alone in feeling that this was a good idea. After all, that's the only way it had always been with high government officials. And he, I think, quite correctly saw that we human beings like titles. We like lofty titles for people in positions of responsibility. And also, as he argued quite characteristically, titles didn't cost anything. And that if you're going to get good people to be in the government, you couldn't reward them with high salaries. And so therefore, maybe you gave them a title, as we give title judge or your honor. You know, it's not as though we have no titles. He just wanted larger, fancier titles than were called for.
Well, the Honorable Joe Smith,
yes,
who once served as a circuit judge or something.
Yes, and he... And, of course, they began to mock him, and they said, well, his title should be his rotundity.
Yes.
And he was made a laughingstock. Now, he learned the lesson. He didn't make a mistake like that again. I also think it's not unimportant that Abigail was not there at the time. She was still back in Quincy. I wonder if he would have gone ahead with it had she been there. She probably would have said, not now, John. Don't do that, John. She had pretty good sense about things like that.
She was really a great political wife, wasn't she?
She really was. Yeah. I know I'm skipping ahead, but there's an incredible scene, which I believe I've reported for the first time in this book, having found her notes Massachusetts Historical Society, where all the Adams papers are. She kept some notes of a conversation she had at the White House after Adams had lost the election to Jefferson, but Jefferson had yet to be nominated.
That's 1800 thereabouts.
Yet to be inaugurated. Yes, this is in 1800, and late 1800. And Jefferson came to the White House for dinner, and he's the president-elect. And he's been the vice president for a long time, and he's the leader of the Republican, then later the Democratic Party. And he's sitting beside her, and he begins asking her, who are these people around the table? And they're congressmen. They're members of Congress. And he doesn't know their names or anything about them. And she tells him their names, gives him a little sketch of their background and what their positions are, which he finds fascinating. But you see, she knew these people. And it wasn't just that she'd done this as a requirement as part of her role in being the president's wife. She'd done it because she was really interested, and she was very, very bright. Then she turns and says something funny, and it's quite funny, and he laughed. And she records that she had made Jefferson laugh. Now, Jefferson didn't laugh an awful lot. And so you get a sense of this woman who is both very much attuned to the center of political action, and who's who in the cast, and who also has the capacity to be quite funny, and as was Adams. Adams had a marvelous sense of humor. He and Franklin, of the founders, have the most active senses of humor. He was a great storyteller. He loved stories, as did Franklin. And for all their differences, I think the two of them really quite enjoyed each other's company when they were telling stories and enjoying humor.
I think one
of the funniest scenes in the whole story is when Franklin and Adams spend a night in an inn in New Jersey on their way up to Staten Island to see Admiral Howe, and they sleep in the same bed. And Adams gives this very funny account of how Franklin wanted the window open and Adams wanted the window closed. Franklin had the theory that we needed fresh air.
Yeah.
And, of course, the conventional wisdom of the day, which Adams was in agreement, was that you kept the window closed at night because the poisonous vapors were out there and they would come in and make you ill. And Franklin says, have you ever heard my theories about fresh air? And Adams said, yes, he had. He'd read them. But Franklin then proceeded to tell him anyway, and he describes how he very happily fell asleep listening to Franklin run on. It's a wonderful scene. And there are so many moments in this life where his humor is often about himself, where he can be very sort of self-centered, self-admiring, self-pitying. But then at the end of the letter, he'll turn and say something where the joke's on him. So he does know his own faults. He's his own severest critic. You saw a play, I'm sure, 1776, or the movie.
Mm-hmm. I did see the movie.
You may remember this. The whole bit.
They did it as the main character. They did it as a musical. Actually,
yes,
didn't they?
That's what I meant. Yeah. Musical. He's the main character in that.
Yeah. Movie.
Rightly
mm-hmm.
so, because he was at Philadelphia. And there's a whole number. Why don't you sit down, John? Please be quiet, John. You're so obnoxious. Why don't you sit down? Well, I looked through all the memoirs, the letters that were written at the time, the diaries, and so forth, of the people who were there. Not one is there any suggestion that John Adams was obnoxious, except one in John Adams' own writing. Years later, 40-some years later, he wrote in a letter, I must have been obnoxious back then. In fact, those people who were there would all say he was the man. He was the one that drove it through. I think while there's no monument to John Adams in Washington, there is in Washington in the Capitol of the rotunda of the Capitol building that enormous, very important painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence by John Trumbull. And all the cast of characters is pictured there, every one of them, many of whom Trumbull painted from life, sketched from life before doing the large painting. And at the very center of the painting, right exactly at the focal point, and all the devices the artist can use to pull the eye toward that focal point are employed there. The focal point is John Adams. He's at the center, front and center. And Trumbull didn't just do that because he thought that would be a nice way to design the picture. That's intentional. And it was also what everybody that he conversed with as he painted their portraits undoubtedly was telling him, certainly many of them, that John Adams was the man who made it happen. So that we have to be very careful, it seems to me, not to take the criticisms that he made of himself to be necessarily the criticisms of the others. The most derogatory and often quoted statement about Adams was by Benjamin Franklin, where Franklin had gotten pretty fed up with him over in Europe, thought he was demanding too much from the French. And he said, he's a man of honesty and integrity and means well, but sometimes he's just out of his senses. And that would be repeated again and again and again, up to the point that by the time of the election of 1800, people were saying, those who were trying to smear him, those who were against him politically, that he was crazy, that he was insane.
And indeed, during the 4 years of his presidency, 1796 to 1800, one of the main things on his agenda was the very troubled relationship with France. In fact, we were on the verge of war with France, and he finessed that in a very interesting way. We need to talk about that and other aspects of his presidency, which we will do directly after we pause for these words and then for a quick update on the evening's news. Is there any way, David McCullough, that we can properly summarize the presidency of John Adams, 1796 to 1800? I mentioned one crucial matter, the trouble with France.
Well, the French Revolution had taken place, and John Adams, almost alone among Americans, warned that the revolution would lead to dreadful bloodshed and would give rise to a dictatorship. And, of course, he was right. That's exactly what happened. The Jeffersonians, the Republicans, were strongly in favor of the French Revolution, strongly, very extraordinarily excited by and gratified by the French Revolution, because they saw it, as did many Americans, as an extension of our own revolution. However, when it turned ugly, it became increasingly clear that things were out of hand, and there was a sort of a pulling back on our part as a nation from what was happening in France. The problems of France, the theme of France, is a strain through the whole political life of John Adams and of the country. I must say, in my own experience, for example, I had no real understanding, certainly not the kind of understanding I have now, of the immense impact of the French Revolution on our own history and our own politics. Because it was the French Revolution that really divided these two parties, the Federalists and the Republicans, as much as anything else. Adams came into office succeeding George Washington, who had promised and urged the country to maintain neutrality. No entangling alliances with Europe, stay out of European wars, and Adams was determined to fulfill that policy. However, his own party, particularly what were called the High Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, were very much against France, very much against the French Revolution and what was happening to France, and wanted to side with the British, saw the British as our natural allies and our natural trading partners, and that their future would be best ensured by being their friends and being their in business with them. The Republicans felt exactly the opposite. They saw the Federalists as monarchists who were going to bring the British form of government to this country, and they were going to side with the French. We then found ourselves at war with the French at sea, an undeclared war. Now, this was all the time that Adams is president.
Let me ask you, what was the French motivation in going after our merchantmen and commandeering them? And what was their interest?
Oh, they wanted the trade, they wanted the profit, they wanted seamen to man their ships. Mm-hmm. They were in a stiff competition. They were at war with Britain,
and they were essentially doing pirate forays against
exactly.
us.
Exactly, and they just let their ships come over and take anything they wanted. Yeah. We'd sail right into our own harbors. And we're confiscating millions and millions of dollars worth of goods, taking ships, taking personnel. And we had no navies to stop them. Well, Adams said, we've got to build a navy and build it fast. He wanted peace with France, and he was going to work for peace with France, and he was not going to be rushed into a war that he didn't think we should fight. But at the same time, he wanted to build up the navy. So he wanted to increase our military strength and work for peace. Now, that was a concept that the Republicans, and Jefferson in particular, simply could not understand or tolerate. How could you be arming yourself in one hand and holding out the olive branch with the other hand? Well, of course, anybody would say that's exactly the symbol of our nation.
He was a classic scholar. Do you remember the old Romans saying, "Desiderat pacem, praeparat bellum"? If you desire peace, prepare for war.
Well, that's very good, Milt. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be with you. It's exactly right. And he built the navy. He built up the navy, and the buildup of the navy was very rapid. It's amazing how fast they could build those ships then. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. When you consider they had no power tools, they had none of the equipment that we use, but they had large numbers of people who could come in and they knew how to do one thing, and they could do that one thing very well, and then the next group would come in and do that one thing. In any event, we built what they called the wooden walls, our protection of the naval fleet. And we were at war. Battles were being fought at sea. Adams did not want to see it escalate into a larger war. And we sent a delegation over to find peace, and the delegation was humiliated, told to leave the country.
Three men.
Well, no, then we sent another group who went over, John Marshall being among them,
right.
And Elbridge Gerry.
His old friend from
and they came back and said, Talleyrand, who was then the foreign minister for the French, which was at that point run by a five-headed directorate.
The directory.
And he came back and said the French want peace. They want to negotiate. Well, the Federalists didn't want to believe that, and they wanted proof of that. And again, there were affronts to our nationhood, and Adams decided he would try one more time. And this was the great brave decision of his presidency, which was to send another group across to negotiate for peace. Now, Marshall and Gerry were the group that met with who were known as X, Y, and Z. They were representatives of Talleyrand who came to them and said, if you sweeten us up financially and personally, you can continue negotiations.
The figure was $250,000. Was that per person or for the three?
Well, and for Talleyrand, too. And $250,000, that would be, goodness me, $25
million
today.
Of course.
It would have fixed all of them for life. And they weren't bribed. They wanted to be bribed. And Marshall and Gerry and said no. And that's the, one penny of tribute. And that broke down the negotiations, but Adams then decided to send another delegation. And that was the bravest decision of his presidency.
Which made him rather unpopular.
Not only made him very unpopular with his own party,
it
was exactly what the Republicans wanted. They wanted to make peace with France at any price, but they were never going to give John Adams credit for doing it. They thought it was a trick, and he succeeded. However, the word didn't come back from France, and by then Napoleon was in power, so this next delegation that went over was dealing with Napoleon, and he made peace, but the news that they had succeeded didn't get back until about 2 weeks before the election of 1800, and as a consequence, among other reasons, Adams lost the election.
By that time, a party system had emerged. There were the Federalists, high and otherwise.
Yes.
And that's where we locate Adams. And there were the Republicans, which will confuse some young listeners, because the Republicans became the Democrats.
Yes.
And Thomas Jefferson was their leading figure.
Yes.
What were the differences between those two groupings? Of course, Washington, even in his farewell address, urged that we avoid the formation of factions.
Washington and Adams believed that the party politics would destroy the country.
Yeah.
Factions. And in essence, it was their feeling that people would begin to consider the fortunes and the future of the party more important than the fortunes and future of the country.
Could one state, of course one can, in fact in the book you do, what were the issues that divided these two early parties?
Well, essentially the Republicans, now known as the Democrats, wanted a strong legislature, a relatively weak presidency, and stronger influence and importance among the states. They were states' rightsers. The Federalists wanted a strong federal government, a strong president, and they wanted the power to be in the North. They were Northerners. The Southerners who were Federalists saw this as a threat because they saw the bankers and the financiers and the big cities of the North wresting power from
them. You could really say, couldn't you, that this difference between those two factions, which became parties, was not finally adjudicated until the Civil War.
That's exactly right. And at the heart of it, a lot of it, of course, was the very issue of slavery.
Yeah.
And Adams, among others, saw this as someday tearing the country apart. He imagined armies marching in the sky, black armies marching in the skies, dressed in armor. But there were other differences, too. The real rivalry, the real hatred, indeed, was much more between Hamilton and Jefferson than Jefferson and Adams. To Jefferson, it appeared, I imagine, that Adams had been taken in by these people,
mm-hmm.
and that the real power behind the Adams presidency wasn't anybody else other than Alexander Hamilton. The irony is that during the election of 1800, which was the most vicious election, I think, in our history, Hamilton, the leader of the Federalist Party, turns in the last month or so, the last hours of the, if you will, of the campaign, of the election, and publishes a vicious attack on Adams to kind of get him, to destroy him. And there are all kinds of theories why he did it. I'm not even sure he knew why he did it, but he did it. And that certainly didn't help Adams' fortune. And the election turned out to be very, very close. The picture of Thomas Jefferson being swept in by a sort of Democratic sweep, you know, lowercase d, is really quite inaccurate.
There's a period of some 10 years when Adams and Jefferson, who once were colleagues, are totally out of touch. In fact, they're just not in contact with one another. They're avoiding one another. When are those 10 years?
Well, they don't speak to each other. Starting at about 1797, and they don't really resume correspondence until 1812. However, there were some instances where they exchanged a few letters.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the death of Adams' son, when Adams was in the White House, the same week that he learned that he had lost the election to Jefferson, he and Abigail learned that their second son, Charles, a very lovable fellow. Adams was extremely fond of Charles. I had died of alcoholism at 30 years old. Absolutely heartbreaking news. And Jefferson came to the White House. Jefferson came to see Adams. They were speaking, but just barely. After Adams leaves the White House, then all communication with Jefferson stops from 1801 to 1812, 11 years.
Yeah.
And
was there a personal antipathy that somehow overcame higher considerations?
Yes. They.
What was the basis of it?
Well, after Adams has left the presidency, they discover, because of the publication of letters by the notorious scandalmonger James Callender, who had been smearing Adams continuously all through Adams' presidency, calling him insane, calling him a hermaphrodite, calling him a fool, and a monarchist, which the monarchist itself was a smear word. That was like calling somebody a communist in the 1960s. And Callender, it turns out, was being paid by Jefferson. Jefferson was providing financial support for Callender, which he said he was doing as an act of charity. Nobody believed that. Jefferson knew it wasn't so. And when Adams found that out, he felt he'd been betrayed. And his wife felt he'd been betrayed. And she never really forgave Jefferson and wrote him stinging letters of rebuke when Jefferson was in the White House, saying that you once occupied a great place of great affection in my heart, and there's still a corner of my heart that knows love for you, but I no longer have respect for you.
Mm. How did their correspondence resume? And what then was that correspondence?
Well, it had in part to do with the death of John Adams' daughter, Abigail Jr., who was called Nabby, who died a very tragic, horrible death from cancer in the aftermath of a hideous mastectomy done, of course, at a time when there was no anesthetics done there in the house, unimaginable suffering. And her mother and father were in the next room, and they were unbelievably awful. And Adams was a changed man after that. He became noticeably more mellow, more forgiving, more tolerant of the failings and frailties of other people. And his mutual friend, the mutual friend of both Jefferson and Adams, the great Benjamin Rush, one of the most interesting figures of the time, physician in Philadelphia, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Painter as well?
Painter? No.
No? Who's the Benjamin Rush who's the painter? Is that a son?
No. No, Benjamin, there's a Rush became Secretary of State. You're thinking of the Peels, I think.
I'm simply mistaken. Yeah. Let us not detain you over that.
Benjamin Rush says, it's time for you two men, you two fellows, to patch things up and start talking to each other again. What's done is done. What's passed is passed. And encouraged Adams to write a letter to Jefferson. And Adams did. After Nabby's death, he wrote a letter to Jefferson. And Jefferson replied immediately and then commenced an extended correspondence over hundreds of letters, more than 300 letters, over a period from 1812 to 1826, when they both died. As you said at the start of the program, incredibly died on the same day,
that. And also
July 4th.
The last words, supposedly, of John Adams were?
Well, they weren't quite the last words, but they were very near to the last, where Jefferson survives. Jefferson lives, is what he meant, I guess, which, of course, was not so, because Jefferson had died several hours earlier that same day.
Do you get a sense when you view that strange, magical day, 50 years after the signing of the Declaration, and these two men dying within hours of each other, do you get a sense of something?
Yes.
Of destiny somehow?
Yes.
Some higher force moving in us?
Absolutely. And people at the time, including the President of the United States, who was John Quincy Adams, saw this as the surest sign yet that the hand of God was involved with the destiny of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And who was to blame them for feeling that? It wasn't just the two presidents had died on the same day, but the two people who had made the Declaration of Independence happen.
And 50 years after.
To the day. Yeah. To the day. And the last of them. There was one more still alive. And I'll tell you, the reaction of the country, you read the sermons that were preached, you read the eulogies that were delivered by people like Daniel Webster. This was considered an event of unimaginable, more than coincidence,
it was fate. Providence asserting itself.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I must say, most of what was written in the spirit that this is a grand, glorious departure, finale, that these two old men had reached the point of deliverance. And to be delivered on that day was a fitting exit.
This is far less fitting, but we must pause for some commercials. It's also time for me to invite telephone calls. The lines are open. The number is ever 591-7200. 591-7200, 312, the area code, if you're calling long distance. I note that already a good deal of email has accumulated. But for those who are listening to us from far away and listening on the Internet particularly, your best approach is via email, the email address extension 720, as one word, at tribune.com, extension 720, at tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200, right back to David McCullough, author of the new biography, John Adams, that's published by Simon & Schuster. We return after this. And we return to David McCullough. A quick question before we go to the phones. I think I'd like to write a great biography. How do I go about it?
Well, pick a subject for which there's lots of material to work with. You need about 10 to 20 times the material that you're going to eventually use. And pick somebody who, Barbara Tuchman had a wonderful line about that. She said you should pick a subject whose life provides a lens on the time in which he or she lived. And through that life you see that whole slice of history. In this particular subject, I had riches beyond imagining. You know, over 1,000 letters between John Adams and his wife, Abigail. Letters to friends. The letters of Benjamin Rush. The letters of Jefferson, to say the least. Wonderful accounts by innumerable others. But Adams was a vivid and gifted writer. He would have made a great reporter. He would have made a great novelist. His descriptions of other people. Some of the descriptions we have of other people are the best, not only the best we have, they're the only descriptions we have. That extraordinary man, Caesar Rodney from Delaware, who rode 80 miles through the night to get to Philadelphia to cast a decisive vote for the Declaration of Independence. We don't even know what he looked like. The only description that has survived is what John Adams wrote.
And speaking of riding to Philadelphia, you start this book with Adams on horseback with a companion, and they're going through wintry weather, and it's just incredible what the journey from Braintree or from Boston down to Philadelphia is like. And we don't even at the beginning know quite when it is or what they're at.
Or who they are.
Or even who they are.
Well,
it's two writers.
You know, people, I don't, when I'm working on a book, friends and fellow historians, biographers sometimes say to me, well, what's your theme? I haven't the faintest idea what my theme is. One of the reasons I'm writing the book is to find out what my theme might be. Nor do I begin necessarily with some historical thesis or principle. This may sound strange, but I'll tell you, what I begin with is a picture in my head. And I had the picture of those two riders coming through the snow. Bleak, colorless New England day, blowing, cold, grim looking, and there's no sign of their identity. There's no trappings of rank, no retinue following up behind them. It could be any year. They could be anybody. Who are they? Where are they going? And it's John Adams and a young fellow, a young neighbor, shoemaker, named Joseph Bass, who's riding along with him, and they're setting off to ride from Braintree, Massachusetts, to Philadelphia, nearly 400 miles by horseback, in the snow, in the winter. Now, what that establishes, seems to me, is several things. First of all, it shows you that life was pretty tough then. You know, imagine going out to ride 40 miles by horseback in the middle of winter. They're going to go almost 400 miles. It shows you that the horse is the way you get around. And nothing can be moved or communicated faster than the man on a horse. The horse is a symbol all the way through the book. At the end of the book, when he's no longer able to ride the horse, and he says, I can tell Jefferson, I can no longer ride a horse, you know that the end can't be very far. It also shows you that he isn't a summer soldier, that this is a guy who will be there when you need him, no matter how difficult or uncomfortable or stressful it is. And that's the way he is through his whole life. Think how much you had to care to do that, to really care to get there, to take part in it.
You are a great painter of scenes. From your book, Truman, which I read with great delight, and we had a wonderful conversation about it when it was published. But there's one scene that I've often told to others who may not have read the book, which I've always loved. And one even has a visual picture of it. It's after Truman has left the White House and he's back in Independence, Missouri, and he buys a new car. Was it a DeSoto or a Pontiac? You will remember.
Yeah, it was a Chrysler.
It was a Chrysler.
Yeah.
And he says to Bess, "Let's try this new car out. Let's drive to Washington."
Yeah.
And you describe how they start off with utter naivete. It was before there was continuing Secret Service protection for presidents.
Right.
That came, I think, only after the Kennedy assassination. And they start driving. And Harry thinks he's just going to have a leisurely drive to Washington. But very soon a retinue develops around them.
Yes, the cars would drive by him. They'd look over, and they'd see who it was, and then they'd float backwards so they could get another look, and then they'd pull up beside to get another. And pretty soon he was causing traffic jams, particularly on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, where one was supposed to go along at a pretty
and
good clip.
And police and sheriffs and so on come out.
Yeah, everywhere.
It's sort of a triumphal procession to Washington.
Yes, and they would actually try to escort him through towns in order to stop him blocking
traffic.
It's
interesting. My mind has gone to another guy going from home to Washington.
Yes.
It's very different.
Yes.
It's a different method.
Well, several people have said to me, well, aren't there similarities between John Adams and Harry Truman?
Well, of course, one wonders why you chose the two, of course.
I suppose there are. I certainly didn't elect to do a book about John Adams because he was like Harry Truman. There are some similarities. They were each farmer's sons.
Mm-hmm.
They were each people of no wealth. They were both short and not particularly handsome. Actually, they were about middle size. They weren't below the average in height. Each was devoted to his wife, and
they're both decent men.
They were, and they liked common sense, and they spoke their mind, and they were not. They were courageous, and they were sometimes blunt to the point of being tactless. And each was the president during an undeclared war.
Mm-hmm.
However, the differences are vast, principally because they lived in such two different times. The difference between the 18th century and the 20th century is greater than we have any idea. And for all of his many attainments and intelligence, Harry Truman was not brilliant. John Adams was brilliant and learned, really deeply learned. He was the most broadly and deeply read American of his time.
Yes.
More so even than Jefferson.
He bought up virtually all the books in Paris when he was over there.
Well, he tried. It was his only self-indulgence, Adams, was to buy books. He never cared much for fancy clothes or the rest, but he bought books.
We go to the phones. Of course, our lines are completely taken. If you're trying to reach us, you're not getting through. But try again after we say goodnight to some prior caller. Here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I grew up in Virginia and graduated from the College of William & Mary. But I don't think that's biasing me when I ask the following, which is, in the popular mind, it seems that Jefferson really looms large as the father of American independence. And, of course, he's the one who got to set the pen to the paper. But obviously, Adams played this critical role as well, and my question for you is, has Jefferson always overshadowed Adams in the popular mind, or was there a time when Adams was celebrated as much as Jefferson is now?
I would say that at the time, in other words, at the time of the Declaration of Independence, time of the Revolution, Adams would have been celebrated, would have been understood to have been the more important man. He has never overshadowed Jefferson in the years since. However, Jefferson's stock has not always been as high as it became in the latter part of the 20th century. I think the easiest way to see it is that Jefferson was the pen of independence, Adams was the voice. And since the pen, what the pen wrote is recorded, and what the voice said is not recorded, it makes Adams' part a little more ambiguous in memory.
Sir, we thank you for the call, and let's go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is about the conduct of the Revolutionary War. It seems to me that the British fought the war with one hand behind their backs. They could have arrested Adams and Jefferson and Franklin and the rest of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. They could have burned their houses down, burned their farms down. These guys weren't guarded. Why didn't they?
Well, to a degree, what you're saying is true, but the would have had a hard time convincing the soldiers who had to fight the British that they were not a formidable foe that was bent on their destruction. The difficulty of defeating the Americans became increasingly apparent to the British as Washington caught on to the strategy that he must not fight pitched battles if they could be avoided. And that is not until the French army under Rochambeau appeared on the scene to help. The British made some grave mistakes. Enlisting using the Hessians was a mistake. When the Americans began to realize that their own king had sent hired mercenary soldiers to kill them, it pretty quickly vitiated any affection that remained for the king. And when the Hessians committed the atrocities that they did, particularly in New Jersey, it turned many of those people who were sort of on the fence about the Revolution quickly to the side of the Revolution.
What did they do? What did the Hessians do?
Well, among other things, they would bayonet soldiers who had surrendered and seemed to delight in that. And so did some of the British officers.
What do we know about the casualties in the Revolution? Well, how many men were lost?
Well, I can't give you those numbers. And again, of course, more died of disease. As John Adams said,
sure,
more were killed by dirty frying pans than by musket balls. It was a war on a per capita base that was extremely costly.
Mm-hmm.
And the suffering was acute. That when Washington is retreating back across New Jersey, his army, which is this ragtag pickup team, so to speak, is down to only about 4,000 people. The old picture of Washington's troops leaving bloody footprints in the snow when they came to attack at Trenton and Princeton is quite true. They were scarecrows, ill-clad scarecrows. The war was over. It was time to throw in the sponge, throw in the towel. And what does he do? He turns and attacks. You know, that painting of Washington crossing the Delaware is sometimes made fun of as being inaccurate, and he wouldn't have stood up in the boat and so forth and so on. And that's quite true. It is inaccurate. But as a symbol, as an evocation of the importance of that moment, the courage of that moment, the audacity of it, the painting is quite representative. The nadir, the absolute low mm-hmm. point of the fortunes of the United States of America, was in the late fall of 1776, when Washington's army is fleeing the advancing yep. British army, which was going to do just exactly what this man said they should have.
What French general is it who says, "My left flank has collapsed, my right flank is destroyed, my center it has disappeared. I attack."
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what he did. Yeah. I don't know who was it. I should know.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
So another French general said the way you win wars is de l'audace, encore de l'audace, et toujours de l'audace. Audacity, always audacity, and more audacity.
That's right. I mean, I loved Adams' description of why we lost, what happened at the Battle of Long Island, in which we were soundly, brutally defeated. He said, "In general, our generals were outgeneraled."
Here's a question via email.
And this writer says, here's an old question about a trivial matter that has always perplexed me. Would Mr. McCullough care to speculate on why, for all John Adams' importance to the early republic, no portrait of him appears on U.S. coinage or currency?
Well, that is a mystery. The last sort of official tribute to John Adams by the federal government mm-hmm. was, a 2-cent postage stamp published in 1938. He's not on the money. He's not on Mount Rushmore. There's no monument or memorial to him in Washington. However, sir, he is emblazoned, for all time, in the mantelpiece of the in the state dining room in the White House, where Franklin Roosevelt had two lines from a letter that Adams wrote to Abigail on the first morning after his first night in the White House, the first letter ever written by a president from the White House, which was dated November 2, 1800. And two lines in that letter were cut into the wooden part of the mantelpiece were asked to be cut in by Franklin Roosevelt. When Harry Truman redid the White House, as you remember, when it was falling down in the early 1950s, mm-hmm. he insisted that it remain. Then during the Kennedy administration, it was carved into the marble of the mantelpiece. And I've just learned since the book was published that that was really at the direction of Jackie Kennedy, of Mrs. Kennedy. And the lines are, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. Now comes the great line, may none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. Mm-hmm. Interesting that he put honest before wise.
There are some superb illustrations in the book, and that's one of them. Of course, there's a center group in color of portraits done at the time of many of the principals.
Well, I have to say, Milton, and I hope I'm glad to say, this is the most beautifully designed, beautifully produced book of mine I have ever had published.
Yeah.
It's the work of a brilliant woman named Amy Hill at Simon & Schuster. I love books. I love the feel of books.
Of course, yes.
There's the deckled edges, and it has beautiful typography. And as you say, the color reproduction is simply gorgeous.
And I think some of our listeners may be able to find this book in a bookstore.
There's every chance, yeah.
In fact, it's also available, of course, at Barnes & Noble, and you can buy it tonight if you choose by going to our website, WGNradio.com, then going to the Extension 720 program guide. And as you scroll down to tonight's date, you'll see a picture of the cover of the book. And if you click on that, you're on the page at Barnes & Noble, which enables you to buy the book at a reasonable discount. We pause. We're overdue for some commercials, then directly back to the phones. And speaking of our audio archive, program that we've most recently put up so that you can go to the website and hear the full two-hour program instantly is the one we did only a few weeks ago with Cardinal Francis George, the Archbishop of Chicago. Also on the archive is the one we did a few months ago with Ian Kershaw, the British historian who did the major political biography of Adolf Hitler. Those and many other conversations enacted on Extension 720 are available in perpetuity, I hope, on the audio archive, which you get to by simply going to WGNradio.com, then going to the site for Extension 720, and then linking on audio archive. Right now, directly back to David McCullough, who's, and this program, I assure all who are listening, will be on the audio archive, I trust, within a week or so. The new book from which we are drawing is titled directly John Adams. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And we go back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, it's a pleasure to talk to Mr. McCullough. I have a question. I've read, I think, everything that you've written, with the exception of this book, which I'll get shortly, in particular a book of essays. I can't remember the name of it, but it was just a delight to read. It seems to me that anything that I've read of yours, the basic idea that I get out of it is that there's just a delight in unfolding the story. And my question is this. I've read a book recently called The Remaking of Robert E. Lee by a gentleman named Ellman. Fascinating, disturbing book, but one written with a very strong agenda. And my question is this. When you write history or choose a topic, how do we as a reader understand how to filter out or if we should filter out the perspective or the agenda that the author brings to the work.
Well, I personally hope that I bring no agenda to the work. I want to find the truth, and I want to unfold it in the narrative form, and I want to do so as much as possible in a way that will take you into that distant, different time and will help you feel what it was like to have been alive then, and also to know what these people were like. Jack Kennedy once said, all biography comes down to the question, what was he like? And it's essential to understand what their nature was, to understand why things happened the way they did. I think the pull of history, to a large degree, and a biography, is that it deals with two of the great mysteries, time and human personality. It's interesting to me how often great events turn on that elusive, ever-fascinating subject of personality. There are some writers, to be sure, who go about history and biography to make a point. It's like stringing beads for them, and they only put those beads on the string that will wind up giving the arrangement that they need to make the point. I've never worked that way, nor have I ever started off with a specific objective in mind, that I must show this or I must prove that. Nor have I ever set off to write something because I wanted to fill a particular niche in history. I guess the honest answer is I try to write the kind of book I want to read, that I like to read.
Well, let me add something to that, if I may, David. Having lived through the writing of this book and with all the research and all the deep investment you've had in it, what do you come out with in terms of something that you think is a relevant message for our time that we can draw from these events and these people?
I think what I have come away from this experience with is a very profound sense that we must understand who those people were and what they were struggling to attain. We must not see them as gods or superhuman. They were very human beings with failings, frailties, inconsistencies, incongruities. And what's so miraculous is that as human beings, they did what they did. Were they gods? Were they superhuman? They would deserve no credit because gods can do anything. We are, alas, to a large degree, raising a generation of young Americans who are in many ways, sadly, historically illiterate. We also have thousands, millions of new Americans taking their place in our country, in our way of life, who come from very different countries, who come from very different cultures, and who may not know much at all about this period. If you have a continuing indifference toward the past, toward this particular part of our past, this all-important chapter in our history, if we have increasing ignorance about it, that isn't just a discouraging as a mark of a declining society or a declining intelligence as a society. It's dangerous. We must know what is at the basis of our way of life. Why do we have these freedoms? Why, for example, do we have an independent judiciary in this country? That's one of the things that John Adams fought for again and again and again. It was John Adams who said we must have a nation of laws, not of men. How many Americans understand that federal judges, not just the Supreme Court, federal judges are appointed for life? Why is that? Who made that happen? It just didn't fall out of the sky. And we mustn't take it for granted, any more than we must ever take our freedoms for granted. One of the themes of John Adams' life, and one of the profound themes in Jefferson's life, and one of the things that they certainly could agree on, was the absolute necessity of education. In the Massachusetts Constitution, this oldest of all constitutions, written constitutions in the world, he has a clause, unlike that of any constitution that was ever written before, that it shall be the duty of the government to educate everybody, to provide education for everyone. Because he believed, and he was certainly not alone in this, that you couldn't have a self-governing society if people weren't educated. Jefferson said exactly the same thing, was saying exactly the same thing, when he said any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never can be. So that the ideal of an educated population handling its own affairs, electing its own representatives, electing its own executive, abiding by the law. Adams didn't believe that mankind was perfectible, that we human beings are perfectible, nor did he believe that all men are created equal. He said, look around. It defies common sense. We're not equal. Some of us are born with more intelligence. Some are born better looking. Some are born with handicaps. Some have gifts that are cradle gifts that will do them that will give them an advantage all their life. However, he said, we must be equal before the law, and we are all equal in the eyes of God. And we need not only to understand that, but we need to appreciate the degree to which they suffered to make it possible for us. Abigail, in one of the most touching of all her letters, says to her husband in one of the dark times of the Revolution, I wonder if future generations will ever understand, ever know all that we've suffered in their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to know. We must know.
You're really talking about the shaping of the great American idea.
Yes, they were present at the creation.
Yeah.
Imagine, they're starting a new country. They're not, you know, they're not writing a Broadway show or starting some new corporation or something. They're making a country. They're making it from scratch, and they're making it against the wishes of the most powerful nation in the world.
Turning to the human side of this, just at the very end, with only 2 minutes left, the last direct descendant of Johann Sebastian Bach died about 30 years ago, even though Bach was a very prolific father.
Imagine that.
The Adams dynasty became a major presence in American life through all of the 19th century. Does it persist?
Yes, indeed it does. The Adams family have been consistently distinguished by their contribution to our country. I don't like superlatives, but I know a few other families that have done so much. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Charles Francis Adams. Imagine, John Adams was our minister to Great Britain. John Quincy Adams was our minister to Great Britain. Charles Francis Adams, our minister to Great Britain. Henry Adams was easily one of the finest historians we've ever had. There was a very distinguished Adams who only died just recently, a man I knew. And who was very helpful to me in this work, named Charles Adams. And Charles Adams was the head of Raytheon. And he looked just like John Quincy Adams. And here was the same brilliance, the same wonder, and his same wonderful attitude toward learning. Mm-hmm. I once said to him, Mr. Adams, as the head of Raytheon, did you major in engineering or physics in college? He said, oh, no, I majored in the fine arts. And he saw nothing contradictory about that. That fine arts and engineering aren't mutually exclusive. They're all part of the great, wonderful world of learning.
It's been a delight having you here, David. I truly wish we had more hours. The new book by David McCullough, as I think you've caught on by now, is titled John Adams. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And we'll be back again tomorrow after a ball game with a program about travel in Wisconsin, not quite as heavy a subject, or not quite as, I shouldn't say heavy, but not quite as moving a subject as the one we've been discussing tonight. And then we'll be back for a full two-hour program on Wednesday. Until then, my thanks again to David McCullough.
Well, my thanks to you for including me. It's been a delightful evening.
Been looking forward to it for months. And thanks to all for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow, as I said, after the ball game.